Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Canavero. In the War Report, we report on recent developments on wars around the world. We show how these developments fit into the global geopolitical picture and how they affect U.S. national security. In today's edition of the War Report, we need to talk about a very important foreign policy address delivered by President Obama on September 10th, setting forth steps that the United States is taking to combat the recent gains made by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria in those two countries. ISIS is now in control of a broad swath of territory in northern Syria and Iraq. This area starts from northeastern Syria near the large Syrian city of Aleppo and extends east along the southern Turkish border into northern Iraq. In Iraq, ISIS has now captured the important northern city of Mosul, as well as Fallujah, which is much further south and is near the capital, Baghdad. During the course of its advance, ISIS has reportedly killed many innocent civilians as it seeks to impose its fundamentalist brand of Islam, Wahhabism, on the entire region. Its army is extremely well-equipped and is said to number up to 31,500 fighters. Calling ISIS a threat to U.S. national security and citing humanitarian concerns, President Obama on September 10th announced the following actions. One, he said that the U.S. will continue bombing ISIS in Iraq, as well as Syria, if he believes it necessary. Two, he is sending an additional 475 U.S. ground troops to aid the Iraqi army in fighting ISIS. But the president said they would not be in combat and that he would avoid a major ground war. Three, he called for Congress to support funding for additional training and equipment for so-called moderate Syrian insurgents, which he believes will fight ISIS. Fourth, the president said that he intended to attack ISIS and other terrorists wherever they may be found, specifically recalling U.S. past strikes in Yemen and Somalia. Marchand, do you think that the steps taken by President Obama will be sufficient to halt the advance of ISIS?
From a military perspective, absolutely not. Time and again, we've seen that airstrikes alone cannot break the back of an army, let alone insurgency. Airstrikes are crucial when ground troops are advancing. The theory behind airstrikes is to soften up enemy positions, knock out their hardened defensive positions, knocking out their bunkers, knocking out their infrastructure. But at the end of the day, ground troops have to go in and clear the enemy out. And what's happening when you're fighting an enemy like ISIS, particularly one that doesn't wear a uniform, you can't exactly expect to simply drop a few bombs on their leaders and wipe out their command and control network. They don't have an technological command and control network, as would say the Iraqi army under Saddam or the modern Syrian army, where you blow up their lines of communication and whatnot. They operate on a very, relatively speaking, a low-tech level, and their leaders are often hidden. So the only way you're going to root them out is with ground troops. I call this the 007 phenomena or the born supremacy phenomena, the idea that we'll send in a few bombers, a few drones, and we can hit Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, while he's on the toilet. It's just not realistic. The fact is what the president is trying to avoid desperately doing is sending in ground troops. The longer he waits, the more troops that will become necessary and the more Americans that will ultimately die trying to stop ISIS.
And of course, we've already seen mission creep in this. When the bombing campaign started, President Obama said it was very limited, and there was a chorus that repeated that on the media the day the bombing campaign started, all saying this is very limited, very limited. And then a couple of days later, we find out it's going to go on indefinitely. And now, just recently, the Chief of Staff, General Dempsey, said that ground troops are not ruled out. And a new study that came from the so-called Institute for the Study of War calls for 25,000 ground forces in Iraq and Syria to try to combat ISIS.
You don't have to be Napoleon or Caesar or Guderian to figure out that you can't defeat an insurgency simply with air power. Afghanistan proved that. Vietnam proved that. Unless you want to go in and carpet bomb all of the civilian centers, which, by the way, I am not in any shape or form an advocate of, But unless you want to go in and carpet bomb and flatten every civilian center ISIS is in, there's no way you can do it because, as I mentioned before, they don't have an infrastructure to hit. They don't have armored brigades for us to knock out. They don't have command and control centers we can hit.
No, it's just civilian infrastructure like bridges.
What is the situation in the ground on Iraq now?
Well, right now it seems to have hit more or less a stalemate. And a lot of that, both in Iraq and Syria, is thanks due in part to the Iranian troops that are present on the ground and to, in the case of Syria, the Russian troops that are present on the ground. There are very large numbers of Russian troops. I've estimated in my own calculations to be approximately 20,000 Russian troops.
That's in Syria. And you're saying that there are Iranian troops in Iraq or just in Syria?
In both Iraq and Syria, the Mahdi army in Iraq, which is Muqtada al-Sadr's militia who fought against the United States, have been supplied and trained by the Iranians for years. But we can see the tide of battle. If you look at the timeline for the ISIS advance, we can see the tide of battle starting to change when Iran promised to send advisors and when the Quds force, the Iranian special forces, promised to send advisors. And immediately, just as we saw with Syria, when ISIS was advancing, we saw the arrival of Russian troops, and automatically the ISIS and the Syrian Free Army advance completely ground to a halt. We're seeing the same thing in Iraq, but now it's more or less a stalemate.
And here, of course, the religious element is very important because Iran is the leading Shia nation, and Iraq is predominantly Shia.
Exactly. Iraq is predominantly Shia. Syria is a little bit more complicated because they're a mix of minority Shia and predominantly Sunnis. Although these people are far too radical even for most Sunnis, the Sunnis in both Iraq and Syria tend to, in large parts, be supporting the governments. What's propping ISIS up, sadly, is our ne'er-do-well allies, the Saudis, the Gulf states and whatnot, who've been pumping ISIS with money. And indeed, even our own administration, who has been supplying quote-unquote moderates, yet mysteriously the arms and money that we give to the Syrian Free Army seems to end up in the hands of ISIS, which makes Obama's whole statement about supplying moderates totally lunatic. And indeed, Syria presents us with a unique opportunity, and so does Iraq. ISIS is despised not just by the United States, but by the Russians, the Chinese, the Syrians, and the Iranians. This gives us the unique opportunity to go to the Russians, to go to the Syrians, to go to the Iranians and say, look, we have not seen eye to eye for a very long time, but we have a common enemy. If we can all work together to defeat ISIS, we not only will show that the United States is a pillar of stability in the Middle East as opposed to a pillar of instability, but we'll also show the Iranians and the Syrians, look, we're not myopically focused on toppling your regimes. In fact, if you play ball with us against ISIS and al-Qaeda, we're willing to work with you. And indeed, the Russians, because the Russians have as much a hatred of ISIS as we do, because ISIS wants to instill a Wahhabi revolution in places like Chechnya. So again, we could bring the Russians into the picture. Mm-hmm. At this point, the coalition we need to be building is not with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, the UAE, and whatnot. Our coalition should be with Russia, Iran, Syria, and the European
countries.
This is
really the key
point. The American allies are all the wrong people.
The wrong people. In terms of geopolitical terms, we have put our lot in with these reactionary, Wahhabi-oriented regimes like Saudi Arabia to the neglect of major powers that have the same interests as we do in regional stability.
Don't you judge the character of someone by the company they keep? Yeah, well, the United States' company is pretty bad.
And so we have not invited, we've disinvited the Russians and the Iranians in solving this crisis. Is that right?
Exactly. Saudi and the Gulf states look at ISIS and they see a potential to be overthrown. They see that if the ISIS revolution spreads in their countries, their regimes are going to fall. So they want to back ISIS so that ISIS will be beholden to them.
March, could you remind the listeners what Wahhabism is and how it connects to ISIS and, let's say, the Taliban and al-Qaeda?
Wahhabism is not mainstream Islam. I'd like to put that out point blank. It's not mainstream Islam. It's not mainstream Sunni Islam. It was a fringe fundamentalist movement started in the 18th century by a man named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And it appealed to the Bedouins because it incorporated a medieval version of Islamic law that fundamentally flies in the face of Islamic law. It incorporated lots of elements of Bedouin tribal law, which are, again, un-Islamic principles. Things like forcing women to cover head to toe is an un-Islamic principle. Beheading people for not converting is forbidden by the third chapter of the Quran, which says that there is no compulsion in religion. Wahhabism took appeal because the Saudi regime which was founded after the First World War, more or less during the First World War, came to power with the help of Wahhabis. And they promised to propagate the Wahhabi ideology if the Wahhabis backed them in their regime. And certainly that's become the mainstream ideology in places like Saudi Arabia. And for the Saudis, Wahhabism became a tool to spread their influence because the king of Saudi Arabia would love to one day become king of the whole Muslim world. And the way to do that is through Wahhabism. Wahhabism fundamentally does not hold any sort of appeal in educated Muslim countries. If you look at places like Turkey, Bosnia, Malaysia, Indonesia, you don't see strong Wahhabism, but you see it in places like Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, places where tribal law has always trumped things like education.
And we found Wahhabis to be convenient allies at times, as in Afghanistan, correct?
Absolutely. We used the Wahhabis to fight against the Soviets, and so did the Saudis. The only difference is that when the Soviet Union fell and the Soviet government collapsed, we washed our hands of Afghanistan. Well, the Saudis didn't. The Saudis kept pumping money into Wahhabi movements such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And the Wahhabis make no secret about the fact that they receive money from Saudi and the Gulf states. Because every Gulf emir wants to one day be the leader of the Muslim world, and the only way they view they can do that is through Wahhabism. Now, one of the things I've been frequently asked is, how is it then that they are able to take over large expanses of the Muslim world? Well, ultimately, Mao Zedong said it best. He said, power comes through the barrel of a gun. And I don't agree with Mao on 99% of what he said, but that is something that's very true. They sweep into a town. The average farmer might not like what's going on, but what's he going to do? These guys are loaded with money and guns supplied by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And then, of course, the U.S. has used Wahhabis numerous times because they're anti-Russian. We funded Wahhabis in Chechnya to fight against the Russians. We didn't fund moderates like Aslan Mashkadov. We funded militants. We funded people who would perpetrate suicide bombings against the Russians because we figured it was a way to help break their back. In the short term, it hurt the Russians. In the long term, as we can see in Afghanistan, as we can see in Iraq and Syria, it's come back to haunt us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc., broadcast on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavero, our producer. And we're talking about President Obama's September 10th announcement of an escalation of the war in the Mideast.
The Mujahideen's tactics, led by Osama bin Laden, was to wear down the Soviet Union and basically bleed them in a unwinnable conflict. They would hide out in the mountains and just draw a fire from the Soviets and just invite more of an invasion so that they would wear themselves down by just overspending themselves. And that tactic is the same one that they're using against the United States. I think their goal is to destroy the American empire by just inviting us to stay forever in the Middle East so that we spend ourselves into oblivion and the American empire bleeds to death.
Have any of the Arab countries made significant contribution to Obama's escalation?
The White House refuses to release which countries are offering to contribute. And my guess is that's because the countries that are willing to contribute are laughable.
No, the Turks said no. They just, if we said, can we use your airbase? They said no.
And the Turks are the most powerful military power in the region.
Exactly.
If we brought in the Turks as well, it would be a coalition of non-Islamic countries, which would be the United States, Europe, and Russia, and then a coalition of Sunni and Shia countries, the combined manpower and firepower of which ISIS would not be able to resist. The biggest problem, though, is that I think Obama's coalition is most likely laughable. We're talking the Gulf states, we're talking Saudi, and these countries are Jordan, and they're not going to commit a million men. They're going to commit a few aircraft, maybe they'll commit a couple thousand volunteers, but that'll be about it. Most of them, in the case of Saudi and the Gulf states, will be playing both sides. We end up doing all the fighting because the allies we bring in are incapable of doing any of the fighting.
Right.
I mean, if we bring in Hungary, Romania, and Georgia, they're not going to be able to make a huge impact. 100,000 Romanian troops, maybe, but a couple hundred Romanian troops?
Right.
That's just laughable.
Doesn't that kind of just go to show that the plan itself is half-hearted, that we don't actually have peace as a goal? Since, you know, I did a lot of reading at the Institute for the Study of War, which is founded by these really, really neoconservative think tank people, like the Kagans, who authored the Surge policy. And, you know, as I heard someone say, they have never met a war they didn't like. Even in their intelligence, it says the only way that this can work is through a coalition of Sunni and Shia countries. It also says in the very front page of the whole piece is that more important than success is Iran cannot be involved.
Yes, we don't want this to be an opportunity for Iran to expand.
So, I mean, right on its face is if that's the stated goal, peace is not the main concern. So if peace is not the primary concern in building bridges, how can you take it seriously? Because it's going to fail.
Well, may I suggest another strategic reason for this new escalation, and that's Syria. We need to talk about Syria.
Yeah.
As we've reported in previous shows, the American efforts to overthrow the government of Syria, which is going on for like about 4 years now, have not been successful.
Right, largely, and they keep trying.
Largely due to Russian and Iranian intervention. The insurgents that we've been supporting are being defeated, and they're really very little chance they were going to overthrow government of Assad. Now, this gives us a pretext for escalating that effort in Syria.
Right.
And in fact, that was a major part of President Obama's program, is to ask Congress to increase the funding for armaments and training for the Syrian insurgents. We're going to give money to these so-called moderate insurgents who then are going to fight with the ISIS insurgents. Do you think, Marshawn, that is...
Our record on overthrows is really, really good.
Do you think perhaps that is the primary objective in this new policy?
I have to wonder, either our leaders are students of Machiavelli or they're students of the village idiot. I'm not entirely sure which one is which. If you're looking at it from the perspective of creating vast amounts of instability, then it works brilliantly. The Syrian Free Army, as such, is not going to stand against ISIS. They'll probably fight alongside ISIS. If we have a successful bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria, it's only going to empower the Syrian regular army to fight the Syrian Free Army. The thing I'd have to wonder is if our bombing campaign in Syria is going to be a half-hearted effort, more targeted against the Syrian army.
Agence France-Presse recently reported that there was an agreement between the ISIS and the so-called moderates.
Syrian Free Army.
It's the Syrian Free Army, not to fight each other. Right. This agreement was entered into in a suburb of Damascus. It was reported by a Syrian authority. I haven't seen other verification for it. According to the report, they agreed that their common enemy was the current Syrian government.
Yeah.
So they were going to fight each other.
Right.
That would seem to be a practical step.
Yeah, they're
going to
join forces and then overthrow Assad, and then they're going to cut the country down the middle. And ISIS will take eastern Syria, and the Syrian Free Army will take the west. That's what's going to end up happening.
So
I think the American government is happy with that result because they don't care about saving Christians or Muslims or Hindus or anybody from ISIS and beheadings and all that stuff. They don't care about that. They care about killing Assad. That's what they care about.
Now, we come back to a phenomenon we've seen over and over again, especially since the Gulf War of 1990, 1991, when it was ginned up in 1990. Which is a propaganda campaign by our government to get the American people behind a war.
That's what we're good
at. It's always about U.S. national security. You know, we're at risk because of these whatever's going on over there in the Middle East. And the second reason for intervention, of course, is humanitarian. Mm-hmm. We've seen these two cards played over and over again. We saw it at the beginning of this in 1990, 91, when Bush Sr. was trying to get us involved.
You can go back to World War I, I think.
Or you can go way back, but certainly since the end of the Cold War. Every war has been characterized often by fraudulent evidence. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Persian Gulf War, we now know that the so-called testimony about the babies being pulled out of Kuwaiti incubators by Iraqi soldiers was completely fabricated by a public relations firm in Washington. The so-called witness, who was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador, wasn't there. She was lying. But that turned out to be key propaganda, which got the Senate to approve the first Gulf War. And we've seen this sort of a falsehood perpetrated over and over again. And Gus, you had mentioned the beheadings. How do we know that these beheadings, which have been extremely powerful propaganda for in favor of an escalation, how do we know that they're authentic?
We don't. And right as soon as the video comes out, they say we're waiting for the CIA to say that they've been authenticated. And then an hour later it comes out, they're authentic. And so we're just supposed to take their word for it. And the videos are banned on YouTube and all other video sharing websites. And the Guardian website, the British newspaper said that you might even be a terrorist if you watch the video. And so most of the people have been terrorized just by the idea of the video. People have not actually seen the video. I have seen all three, by seeing them at a Dutch news website. As you know, I'm a videographer, and I've directed a documentary last year, and I know a little bit about video authentication. I'm a professional photographer and retoucher as well. So if I can just give myself this credibility before I tell you that, in analyzing all three of the videos, there are problems with all of them. And I could tell you without a doubt, first, it is possible to produce that same video, a completely fake version of it, just using actors and stage blood with less than $1,000 worth of equipment. You could use Adobe Premiere, which is the widely available video editing software, which will allow you to take two angles and overlay one over another using what's called Bezier keyframes. And so you just click around the object that you want to remove, and then you place it onto another layer above the video that you want to fake. And a mildly competent video editor could achieve this in roughly 30 to 45 minutes. So it's not even complicated. They're using consumer grade video equipment, which for if there's any geeks out there, using 420 color with a high image compression. It is in HD, but it's been compressed multiple times as it's been downloaded and re-uploaded. So when it comes to actually zooming in on these the high res, you really can't see a lot of detail. For the people who have not seen the video, there is nothing really gory there, because the person with the knife who allegedly is sawing at the person's neck, there is never any blood. And he's sawing so quickly before it fades out really, really rapidly.
It does fade out. You don't actually see.
You don't actually see any cutting.
You don't actually see it being cut. In fact, right. When I looked at it and I had the opportunity to see it, you don't see any blood.
No, there's no blood.
There's no blood in the neck area. Yeah. There is some blood on the top of the head.
Right.
While the supposed killer is sawing away at this the victim's
neck.
That's
only the Foley video.
I said the Foley video. Yeah. There was actually no blood, or there was no evidence.
No,
of
it
cut.
Looks like there's something blood on the temple, but that's only the Foley one. And what I actually think that is reflection of his orange shirt. I don't think that's actually blood.
I see,
blood.
But there is in fact no blood.
There's
in his
no
neck.
Blood on the neck. In all three of the videos, there is no blood at the neck when the guy is using this big hunting knife with a serrated edge, and he saws back and forth, but in all three of them between 8 and 15 times. It's about 12 in the first one, 8 in the second, and 15 in the third.
And then the screen goes blank.
Goes black, and then it comes back and it pans across a body with a head on the back. And it moves very quickly. It's very hard for me to go frame by frame and actually pick out the mistakes that could be made if it was false. But in the third one, I am undoubtedly able to pick out where it has been faked, and I can actually see the path around the edge where it does not belong. And what I believe has happened is that they have an image of the body laying flat in the ground with a bunch of blood splatter all over it, and they took another image that they shot of a downward angle at the head, and they cut around the shoulder and the jaw and the head and the other shoulder and placed it on top of the body and then blended it together using a blur at the edge of the layer that they're hoping you don't notice. But I did pick it up, and I can even circle the areas that are blended. And you can see the seam at the top of the shoulder. If you're looking top down at someone's shoulder, the seam of where the sleeve connects, and that is at the wrong angle. And then you can also see the angle of the other arm that's handcuffed has been broken, and it has two different intersecting angles, and the forearm is not continuing. So what that says to me is that is another angle that's been cut together, and they missed it in their haste. There's also sharpness problems where you have a blurred sand from the background inserted into the foreground, so it has background blur in the foreground, which is not possible. The sharpness doesn't have a smooth gradation into blur. And there's no neck anywhere in the image. So it's very, very odd. And by comparison, I watched some Mexican Lazetas beheadings. And the reactions of the bodies, the amount of blood that spills out, completely different. It's completely different.
And we've seen so many falsehoods perpetrated by our government in order to induce the American people to support escalations in wars. It's reasonable for one to be very critical, for one to be very skeptical when this is presented. We saw it, of course, in the Iraq War in 2003 with the so-called evidence of chemical weapons in Iraq, which was presented by the Secretary of State, Colin Powell at the United Nations. It turned out the source of that was a guy named Curveball, and his credibility had been totally discounted by the German intelligence people. But we presented
mobile weapons vans, yellow cake uranium. I mean, it just goes on and on.
And all false.
People listening out there are going to be like, well, are they alive? Are you saying who faked it? I don't know who faked it. I don't know if they're alive. I don't know. All I can tell you is that what I see is not right. It's been faked, And that's up to the government to do due diligence to try to figure out why it's been faked and what the motivation is. I'm not the investigator. Sure. I'm only looking at evidence and telling you that that's not right. I'm just an expert witness here.
ISIS has openly said they want to bomb us in our own cities.
Right.
Assad never said that. The Iranian leaders never said that. The Russians even, even though they've kind of hinted at it, have never said it.
Saddam Hussein never said it.
Exactly. Saddam Hussein never said it. ISIS says directly, we want to hit you in your home. We have agents in your country. And then we're saying we're going to go after Assad. And then we're talking about humanitarian crisis. And ISIS, who, by the way, we've been, as you mentioned before, been funding and arming, mm-hmm. ISIS has been killing hundreds of thousands.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report. We're broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm your host. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Canavero. And we've been talking about the escalation of the war in the Mideast that was discussed and it was announced by President Obama on September 10th. Excuse me for interrupting you, Marshawn. Please continue.
We are pursuing a very dangerous policy by attacking everyone except those that are a direct threat to us because it's politically convenient for certain politicians, in many ways because it may be very profitable for certain politicians. Mm-hmm. We are going after people who aren't a direct threat to us, ignoring those that are a direct threat to us, and meanwhile provoking countries like Russia and China while we are at the same time decreasing the size and the power of our own military.
Marshawn, could you talk about the military situation in Syria right now and what the Russian response might be if we start bombing them?
I'm sorry. Something just popped into my head. Not to mention, we have wide open southern borders. And as I mentioned before, the Los Zetas actively beheads people who try to undermine their influence. I mean, is anybody seeing that we have such a double standard where we're so involved in countries across the world, but yet we could care less about the one directly to the south?
From a military perspective, what we should be doing is we should be building up our national defense. We should militarize our border. Every country is entitled to its national integrity. I don't hate immigrants, but I believe every country has a right to know who's coming in. And certainly the drug cartels are just as bad terrorists as ISIS or Al-Qaeda, plain and simple. And they want to hurt us and create as much instability as ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So that's, you know, point blank. We should be much more careful about provoking people like the Russians, because as you asked earlier, the situation on the ground in Syria has reached more or less a stalemate. The Assad government has slowly been making gains thanks to the help of the Russians there. There are approximately 20,000 or more Russian soldiers. That's not including the naval force that's there. The Syrian missile defense system, air defense system, which is largely made up of S-300 surface-to-air missile systems, some of the newer S-400 surface-to-air missile systems, Iskander ballistic missiles as well, which are all present in Syria. This is all open source. You can Google it. They're all present in Syria. They're manned by Russians. There are Russian Spetsnaz, special forces, on the ground in Syria. If we start a bombing campaign, if we knock out one of these missile systems or accidentally blow up a truck full of Russian soldiers, the potential for a mass escalation is huge. Because just imagine how Americans would react if we heard on the news day 30 U.S. soldiers were blown up in a Russian airstrike. How outraged would we be? And to add on to that, the fact that we've been antagonizing the Russians in the Ukraine, I mean, something that might sort of be willing to look the other way, but the fact is that we have so antagonized them in places like Ukraine and Crimea that the Russians clearly, it wouldn't take much to push their people into saying, you know what, let's knock the U.S. in the nose. And the fact is we've been relying on the impressiveness of our firepower from 2003. That was 11 years ago. And since then, our military is downsized. We can delude ourselves. We can watch movies like The Bourne Identity and think that we could hit Putin while he's on the toilet. But the fact is that they know all of our weaknesses. They know that they can produce 20, 30 tanks for every one of ours. We used to have four armored brigades. We now have one armored division, first armored. That's it. The Russians, by comparison, have 13, 14 armored divisions. They have over 900 tanks that we know about. That's not counting, you know, thousands of aircraft and whatnot. Meanwhile, we're decommissioning aircraft. So it wouldn't take much to really sock us in the nose. And not to mention the fact that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, led by both China and Russia, have mutual defense agreements, meaning that who really cares about Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan? But look at China. People need to realize that by antagonizing the Russians, if we kill Russians in Syria, the potential knock-on effect of this is not going to simply be to have a really annoyed Russia go, you shouldn't do that. But the potential knock-on effect is to drag both Russia and China into a war that, frankly, we at present are not capable of winning.
Gus and Marshawn, what's your view of what the political situation would be? What would the American people do if President Obama miscalculates, bombs Syria, the Russians retaliate, and then he finds himself enmeshed in a major war in Syria? Will the American people support sending a large army, perhaps of conscripts, to fight in Syria?
It's so easy to get the American public riled up for this rah-rah America go team stuff, that because we have such a culture of sports and conflict and egotism, that I don't think it would be too difficult, especially if they framed it in the right propaganda. Last year, 2 years ago, when President Obama claimed falsely that Assad was gassing his own people, and it turned out it was actually the rebels that were using the gas, and the gas was made in Saudi Arabia, people rose up against it. They called Congress, and we did not invade Syria. We didn't attack Syria. But you see the polls have shifted to a supermajority of about 71% of the public is behind going back into Iraq, even though it was such an unpopular war. By all accounts, it was a mistake and it was a complete blunder, and we've lost all credibility internationally. We've bankrupted ourselves. Yet they're still in it for the long haul to go back in and reassert our dominance.
And then we come back to the importance of propaganda and the beheadings, which may have not been
and which most people authentic. Have not even seen, because they have been told it's too graphic for them. And yet they're still willing to buy it and go to war.
What do you think, Marshawn? Do you think that Obama could bring the American people behind a major war in Syria?
Most people I talk to don't even understand why we're still interested in overthrowing Assad, when the real threat is ISIS. ISIS is still a bigger threat. ISIS is operative in the United States. Yeah. ISIS is working with the drug cartels on our border to get personnel and chemical weapons into the United States. By President Obama saying, well, we have to go after Syria, he's whipped up a lot of fervor against ISIS, but then he's going after Syria. And I think at some point people are going to start to ask and go, hey, wait a minute, why are we fighting the wrong enemy? I am firm favor of stopping ISIS. I strongly support stopping ISIS, but doing it the right way. Bring in these regional allies. Bring in the Russians and the Chinese. Bring in the Europeans, a coalition of the world's superpower, to demonstrate that not only is the United States a unifying factor, but a force for stability.
Well, Marshawn and Gus, doesn't that presuppose that our objective is world peace and world stability? But if you look at the record, especially beginning with our rejection of Glasnost and Gorbachev in 1990. Of course, we won the Cold War, largely in thanks to President Reagan and the large defense expenditures, which bankrupted the Soviet Union, which had lost a lot of troops and a lot of money in Afghanistan. Gorbachev threw in the towel. He unilaterally gave up the Brezhnev Doctrine, which essentially he pulled out of Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And he also made the Soviet Union a voluntary association. We were incredibly bold steps. He wanted to establish really a democratic state. He legalized the non-communist parties. He had free elections. And he was really a dawn of a new era. Mm-hmm. And then Bush Sr. comes into office, and he looks at that situation, and he just sees it as an opportunity.
Like a great white shark who smells blood in the water.
To crush Russia. We get Yeltsin, who seems to be our man in the Soviet Union, to refuse to join the new Soviet Union. Without Russia, the new Soviet Union failed. Gorbachev falls from power. And we then immediately move in and we dismember the Soviet Union's economic base, wreck the ruble, have foreign investors take over their national oil and gas companies, and pretty much loot the country. Mm-hmm. So obviously our objective was not to seize this opportunity and create world peace. Our objective was to use the fall of the Soviet Union as a moment to assert U.S. hegemony globally. And then we immediately, after the fall of the Soviet Union, began the Persian Gulf War, followed by the war in Yugoslavia, where we broke up as that strategic nation into small pieces, establishing very large military bases there, followed by, of course, the the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. And of course, we've talked many times about that famous memo that General Wesley Clark talks about on television right after 9/11, when he saw this memo in the Pentagon out of the Office of the Secretary of Defense calling for the conquest of seven important countries in the Mideast and North Africa as well, including Iraq and Syria,
Libya,
Libya, Somalia. And the final prize was
Iran.
Was Iran.
Yeah.
This was just weeks after 9/11.
And so, lo and behold, this is basically what we have. We're in the seventh inning of that plan.
And these conquests, these wars, are always presented the American people as if they're ad hoc, as if they're motivated purely by...
They just happen.
They just happen. Yeah. Humanitarian reasons compel us to intervene.
No, it's pre-planned.
But this does not appear to be the case.
It's a game plan. It's a domino effect, one after the other. First we get to this, then we get to this, then that. And it's clear to say that humanitarianism is not in the bones. The United States government does not have a kind bone in its body. And I wouldn't even trust Hillary Clinton to walk my dog, let alone plan what the next regime should be in Syria, because they have a terrible record on backing good people.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. The show will be archived at WPKN.org and on our website, incontextreport.com. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm your host. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, and our producer, Gus Condovero.
Well, and as I mentioned before, it's a very dangerous game we're playing. Empires have a role in civilization, and indeed one might even say a necessary evil in some cases, because when you look at Europe pre-World War I, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Prussians, the Russian Empire, the British Empire, the French Empire, they all sort of balanced each other out. But again, there was that understanding. We're not going to push into your sphere. We're not going to try regime change in your sphere. You don't try it in ours. And what ultimately broke into World War I, and indeed we saw a very similar thing with World War II, was when one other country decided, no, I want your sphere. You seem weak enough. I want your sphere. I want regime change in your part of the world. And the thing is that to have true world stability, the superpowers need to have a common understanding. And in the case of World War I, the Archduke of Austro-Hungary, Franz Ferdinand, was shot by Gabriel Princi, Bosnian Serb, who was a member of a Serbian militant movement, the Black Hand. And Austro-Hungary, instead of saying, okay, Russia, Serbia is your sphere, we're ticked off, but you deal with it, Austro-Hungary said, no, we're going to take Serbia. And Austro-Hungary was militarily and economically in about the same position the United States in, and therefore went to war. We see the same thing when Japan decided wanted to get into the empire game. Japan wouldn't have been happy waiting a little while to grab some colonies in parts of Asia or Africa. They decided, no, I want part of Britain's sphere of influence. I want part of the American sphere of influence. And so they made land grabs, and boom, you had World War II.
And Marshawn, as we look at this, I'm sorry, complete your thought, Marshawn.
I was just saying that so what we're seeing here is the dangers of regime change. Again, one of the things that happened immediately after the Cold War was Truman met with Stalin and said, look, this part of Europe's yours, this part is ours. Stalin agreed to let the communist movements in Italy and Greece, which were very strong, fall to the Americans, because the understanding was that's your sphere. In the other hand, the United States would not try to push into East Germany. We wouldn't try to establish democratic movements. We let the Czechoslovakian revolution collapse, because there was that understanding with Stalin, indeed later on that understanding with Khrushchev, that's your sphere.
This is 1968.
This is 1968. We will not attempt regime change in your sphere if you do not attempt it in ours. And therefore, as had happened with empires previously, there was, relatively speaking, large global stability. If you exclude Vietnam, there was, relatively speaking, global stability.
Yes.
But and the Korean War. But we would push each other in proxies, you know, like Korea, like Vietnam. But there was no sense that, you know, we were going to try to roll tanks into East Germany. Now the problem you have is that American leaders, people like Victoria Nuland, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, have this notion, the Austro-Hungary complex, as I like to call it, that we can make regime change in the Russian sphere, and what are they going to do about it? We're too powerful.
You're alluding, of course, to the Ukraine. And if we do look at these global wars in terms of the great power politics, Syria Kielai of Russia. That's where their sole Mediterranean port is, and in Syria. They're not about to let Syria fall to the United States. And similarly, Ukraine is very key to Russia, formerly part of the Soviet Union. We staged a coup there recently, put in a pro-American government, and they're obviously feel very threatened by that. So we need to talk about the Ukraine.
And this is exactly why I'm a libertarian. I believe in a small government, if not even an anarcho-capitalist kind of society, because the state needs war in order to maintain its stability. The state needs a constant enemy and a constant state of strife in order to maintain its power. War is the health of the state. And if you have an empire without an enemy, then you have no reason to be at a constant heightened alert, feeding that militarism. And people may actually start to demand a stand down.
It's 1984.
Right, exactly. Well, so they need an enemy at all times. And that's why the Soviet Union was just so useful to the American empire.
Well, and that's why personally, when people ask me, am I Republican or Democrat, I say I'm a nationalist. Because there are enemies out there. The problem is that because it's profitable, because it's politically convenient, we ignore the real enemies. We ignore the drug cartels. We ignore the
Democrat and Republican parties.
And you know, people exactly. get confused. They think that they try to categorize the In Context team as right or left. We're not right or left. We're not Republican or Democrat.
Right.
We're out for what the best interests of the American nation and the American people. And we don't come at this from an ideological perspective.
The first question we must ask ourselves is this what is best for the American people? And the true enemies of the United States are those that are bringing violence across our borders and the big industrialists and bankers who've shipped all of our jobs and all of our industry over to China and India. To me, in my mind, taking jobs away from hardworking Americans and giving them to the Chinese and Indians is tantamount to treason, because you are depriving America of its lifeblood. And to me, that's a far greater enemy than Iran or Syria or Bashar al-Assad could ever be.
No, they've never been able to prove what the national security interest is in these situations. So that's why they have to create frauds like weapons of mass destruction, because, they could use it here. And WMD could mean anything, and people automatically assume it means nuclear warheads or suitcase nukes or dirty bombs. And so they think that they're in danger, when in reality, Switzerland has never been bombed by a terrorist because they don't bother people.
Well, now, Marshawn, just as Syria is a prospective battleground between Russia and the United States, so too is the Ukraine. Well, what's the situation on the ground now in Ukraine?
Right now, they have a ceasefire agreement, but the situation is very fragile. There's been exchanges of fire during the week of the 17th. There were exchanges of fire between Ukrainian and pro-Russian troops. The pro-Russian troops attempted to assault the Donetsk airport. There was shelling outside Mariupol, which is a Ukrainian coastal city. So the situation is very fragile, at least as it stands. The potential here, especially with the greater involvement in NATO troops, there was an exercise not that long ago between approximately 1,500 NATO troops, to include Americans in the west of Ukraine, and the Ukrainian army. Additionally, the EU has agreed to supply the Ukrainian army with lethal arms, with weapons as opposed to MREs. And the danger we see here is that if the Russians feel it's necessary or they feel it opportune to provoke it, they can drive to Kiev in a matter of days, if not hours.
The recent reports suggest that there has been a counteroffensive, and the United States State Department is charged that the apparent success of the pro-Russian Eastern secessionists in recent weeks has been the result of Russian help. What do you think of that?
Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the head of NATO, showed satellite imagery of Russian tanks and Russian artillery crossing the border. So it was a lot of this amateur footage of the advancing pro-Russian troops. They were driving the latest and greatest Russian T-90 battle tanks. Now, this isn't just a piece of hardware you can hand to an idiot and say, drive it. It requires somebody who actually knows what they're doing. And granted, you might have a large number of veterans who live in eastern Ukraine, but not necessarily a large number of people who know how to use tanks. Moreover, the use of Russian heavy artillery by the Ukrainian rebels, again, demonstrates that these are people who know what they're doing and adds validity to the theory that there are a lot of Russian troops there. Moreover, the people in eastern Ukraine would welcome the Russian troops. All they have to do is, just like they did in Crimea, they take off their unit patches and roll in.
How do we even know that the satellite footage they're showing is recent? 2 months ago, they were showing footage of Russian tank columns amassing on the Ukrainian border, and it turned out it was from 2 years ago when they were doing a drill.
I hold it in conjunction with the battlefield evidence. Again, the fact that heavy artillery cannot be operated properly by amateurs, as we could see from the Syrian Free Army. The Syrian Free Army captured loads of Syrian tanks and artillery and couldn't mm-hmm. use them at all.
Right.
They were hitting their own people. They were, you know, firing at nothing.
Yeah. And they make a great paperweight.
And exactly.
Of course, the real issue here is whether the Ukraine is going to be roped into NATO, into the EU. The president of Russia that was overthrown refused to enter the EU and NATO. And when he was replaced, the new president, of course, embraced these ideas. And the new Ukraine president, Poroshenko, is planning to meet with President Obama to discuss a military alliance outside of NATO. So it's hard to see how the Russians could tolerate this.
Well, that's why, if you ask me personally, this peace is just a temporary ceasefire, because more likely than not, it will spark off again. Russia is not going to allow Ukraine or Petro Poroshenko, the president, to dictate terms to Russia. Putin, he is really a Peter the Great. He wants to build the Russian empire. He wants to restore it to its former glory. He wants to make Russia the superpower. And necessarily, who could blame him? We want to make America great. Every leader should want to make their country great. Putin is enabled to do it by the fact that we're provoking, by the fact that we're militarily weak. There was a report earlier in September. It was on the BBC when I first saw it, of a Estonian border guard that was kidnapped by the FSB. And originally, Russia didn't comment on it, but then the FSB, they're the successors to the KGB, made a statement. They said, oh, yes, we kidnapped this guy, but it's because he was a spy and he had spying equipment on him. Well, no, the guy was probably some poor schnook working the border post that night and got nabbed by the FSB. But the reason was crucial. They were sending a message to the Estonians that you're next. They were sending a message to the Baltic states that you're next. The problem is that we could avert this entire crisis if President Obama and President Putin met behind closed doors. President Obama again built up our military and said to Putin, listen, this is your sphere. You can keep your sphere. Have fun with it. It's yours. NATO is ours. We have a tank division in Europe. We our allies are strong. We are ready to go. You cross, just like Reagan did, you cross into Western Europe, we will fight. But Ukraine, Belarus, the former Central Asian republics, that's yours. Go nuts. And then that you would have an understanding, and Putin would be allowed to save face and go back to his people and say, see, I've restored Russian greatness, and then Obama would be able to have averted a major conflict.
You know, this thinking that we're seeing, Marchand, really goes back to the neocons, the Project for the New American Century, where the intelligentsia that came to power, particularly under Bush Jr., saw the end of the Cold War as the opportunity to establish a unipolar world, American hegemony.
A one-world government under the United States.
Even when you look at President Bush, there was an understanding with the Russians. Certain things like the crisis in Ukraine, again, when you had the first Orange Revolution, and it appeared the president who actually won, who was pro-Western, was poisoned by the Russians, Bush stepped back and did nothing. He let it go back into the Russian sphere, because even Bush had that understanding with Putin that this is your sphere, this is our sphere. We can poke and prod at each other, but this is your sphere, this is ours. Now we are putting ourselves in a position where a direct conflict with Russians, where American and Russian troops may one day be facing each other down the barrel of a gun very, very soon. When I say one day, very, very soon. Where did this mentality change? And that's a question I can't answer, but I throw it out there.
If you just tuned in, this is the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. We're on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott-Rowe, and our producer, Gus Cantavero. Marchand, we talked briefly about NATO. Merkel, the head of Germany, made a phone call to Putin, and he told Putin he must, quote, explain the allegations that Russian troops are in the Ukraine. Do you think this response was strong?
What Chancellor Merkel was trying to do was to bring it out into the open. I mean, she knew it was something that the Russians were going to out and out refuse, but Merkel is very clever. Angela Merkel grew up in East Germany. She speaks fluent Russian, and Putin speaks fluent German, having been a former KGB agent in East Germany. President Obama, instead of spying on Merkel, should be using her talents and her abilities to communicate with Putin on that unique level to try to reach a detente with the Russians. Germany's trying to walk a fine line because the Germans, unlike the Americans, the Germans remember the last time the Russians were in Berlin. They remember the last time the Russians were in their streets, and they don't want to see that happen again. Whereas the United States, we can poke and prod at the Russians all day long because ultimately, at the end of the day, when was the last time foreign troops were in our cities? Let's go back to 1812. They're trying to walk a very fine line between confronting the Russians, but at the same time trying to reach an understanding with them.
Would they join with us in a military intervention in the Ukraine? That is to say, Germany and the other NATO allies?
I think it's debatable. If we were stronger in our relationship with the Germans, I think they would. But the fact is that we were spying on them in the first place, which is something you just don't do to another ally. You don't tap your ally's chancellor's phone, you know? So in the
United States does whatever
German,
it wants.
Exactly. In the eyes of the average German, we have really alienated them from supporting us. Uh-huh. And then the other factor is that the second strongest party after Chancellor Merkel's Christian Democratic Party is Die Linke, the left. And they came out of the old East German Communist Party. And they're strongly pro-Russian. If Germany were to join in, you might have a political revolution where the left would suddenly sweep to power and we would find a, at best, neutral Germany, at worst, a Germany that was arrayed against us.
Incidentally, Marshawn, you may have noticed that German TV recently aired videos that showed Nazi symbols on the helmets of the Ukraine soldiers.
And that's something that really hasn't helped us either. A lot of the support for the more or less pro-Western government has come out of these shadow Nazi movements. The main militia in Ukraine, the Azov Brigades or Azov Battalion, they are a neo-Nazi movement. They use the old SS Wolfsangel, which was the symbol for the Das Reich division of the SS, but was also a symbol for the Werwolves, the German Nazi guerrillas. And they've also introduced the SS lightning bolts. They've introduced the Roman salute and whatnot.
All very encouraging symbols.
Exactly. Incidentally, the Roman salute in and of itself is not a Nazi symbol.
Right.
It's a symbol of republicanism. It was a Roman symbol. It was used in the French Revolution. The problem is you have to worry about the people who are wielding it. Because if these guys were just playing, you know, we believe in a republic, we're strong Republicans, you know, and they were throwing up that symbol, then yeah, fair enough. But when you combine that symbol with the SS runes, the Wolfsangel, and things like that,
right,
you start to wonder. And there are a lot of these movements, such as in Latvia, where there is an SS monument. And these are the people we've chosen to ally ourselves with. Especially for the Germans is very worrying, because the Germans have been trying to reconcile the Nazi past. They've been trying to put it in a historical context, say, yes, it was a bad part of our history, but we moved on from that. Now they're seeing that in Western Ukraine, and they're thinking, we don't want to be associated with this.
Mm-hmm. Marshawn and Gus, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of the show, but would you have any final comments you'd like to make to the audience?
I think NATO is probably the best club that you can be a part of, because if you get attacked, the U.S. will come bail you out, but you don't have to return the favor.
And Marshawn, any final thoughts before we close the show?
My final thought is we have to stop thinking about how we can provoke these countries that fundamentally we shouldn't be provoking or fundamentally we don't have a grievance with. And we really need to focus again on what is best for the United States. Again, we need to have a nationalist perspective. We need to think more on, should we be worried about Assad's use of chemical weapons and barrel bombs? Or should we be much more concerned about the cartels on our border, the fact that ISIS wants to blow us up, or the fact that our leaders are shipping all of our jobs overseas? My final message is, let's put America first. Let's put the American people first. If our leaders are not asking themselves that question, is this what's best for the American people? Then they have no business being our leaders.
And the people just need to be consistent with the way that they remember the way that things happened, because a million and a half Iraqis died because of the Iraqi invasions. And the United States government didn't care when they were using depleted uranium in Iraq and causing birth defects and tainting the soil. So if we didn't care about people then, and we don't care about the Mexican civilians who are being beheaded because of the Los Zetas, then why do we care about the Yazidis?
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it with that question. And that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. You can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Cantavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.